When he opened his eyes, there they were, the roaches. They were on him, on his body and the bed, on the floor, on the walls, thousands upon thousands of them, more than he'd ever seen before.
I said, it's time to go.
Centauro flinched, realizing that it was not the roaches whispering to him at all. He sat up, scattering scores of the insects, and saw that it was a man who had spoken. A guard, in fact. Centauro fished for his name.
Dylan?
Yes. But it made no sense. This was the middle of the night. It wasn't time for a shower, or breakfast, or exercise. He froze there, his heart hammering, unsure what to do.
They've come to kill me,
his mind whispered.
This is Church's doing. They've come to finally kill me.
Centauro immediately knew what was going to happen. He would be led from his cell and then set upon by the other guards. They would beat him to death or possibly shoot him. Centauro knew that he had no chance against half a dozen burly guards with clubs or shotguns. The report would be that the prisoner attempted to escape. No one would question a death under those circumstances. After all, he had never been formally charged. Centauro was sure that this facility was an NSA black site, and as far as the rest of the world was concerned, it did not exist any more than he did. Church would simply erase him.
Come on, snapped Dylan. What the fuck are you waiting for, an engraved invitation?
Centauro did not move. The guard sighed and then leaned toward the bars so that his nose and mouth were pressed as far between them as possible.
I told you, he said.
The man was not looking at Centauro, and it seemed like he wasn't even speaking to him. The roaches were all still and silent, and they were not looking at Centauro either. All of them, every single one, had their tiny antennae pointing toward Dylan. Then, as if they were all one creature and not thousands, they turned back toward Centauro. Suddenly they were moving, running all around, scurrying across the floor and up the wall, forming clusters, forming shapes. No, not merely shapes. They formed letters. On the floor beside his bed, and on the three unbarred walls of the cell, the same four letters in each place, the same name. Kuga. Centauro cried out, a sharp, high, shrill sound like a wounded gull. He slid off the bed and onto his knees.
Goddess,
he said, gasping out the question as his heart beat like fists inside his chest.
It is time to go,
said the roaches, not in the voice of the goddess. No, the small creatures spoke as one and in the voice of a man. In Kuga's voice.
Apparently you do need an engraved invitation, snorted Dylan, cracking apart the magic of this moment.
He was a burly man with a crooked nose, a lantern jaw, and a North Jersey accent. Not once in all of Centauro's time there at Area 94 had the guard betrayed even a hint that he was crooked.
Get up and get dressed, brother. This shit's about to get loud and messy, and we need to be ready to rock.
Centauro, still confused, leapt up, pulled on his orange coveralls and thin-soled boat shoes.
Leave everything else, said the guard. You won't need it.
But before Centauro could get the question out, the whole world seemed to shudder as something exploded. It was a massive blast, too, and instantly alarms began blaring throughout the prison. Inmates shouted and screamed from their cells, and in the halls was the thunder of running feet. Centauro gripped the bars, shook them, but they did not budge.
Wait for it, said Dylan, glancing at his watch. Okay, now do exactly what I say. No time for questions. Take your mattress, wrap it around you, and crouch in the far left corner. Do it right now.
Centauro did not hesitate. He snatched the thin mattress and curled into as small a ball as he could manage. The roaches scuttled out of the way. However, as he ducked down, he saw that the insects were all flowing toward the bars. Were they fleeing, or... He stared as the roaches reached the bars and began climbing. They flowed in a bristling mass around and around, climbing atop each other until they were five or six deep. Dylan grinned at them and at Santoro, then he sketched a hasty salute and vanished. Three things happened all at once. There was another explosion in the prison, somewhere above on the administrative level or possibly the roof, and the whole building seemed to lift. Cracks whipsawed along the concrete walls, belching dust into the darkened air. There was the sound of automatic gunfire, a lot of it and in a variety of calibers, handguns, assault rifles, and machine guns. Mixed in with that was the distinctive whirling maelstrom of an electric cannon. But more immediately, more powerfully, the thousands of cockroaches clinging to the bars exploded. Santoro did not actually see it, but he felt it. The force of the blast punched him back against the wall and drove the breath from his lungs. Debris, shattered metal, and broken stone hammered the mattress and set it ablaze. Dazed, coughing, dizzy, Santoro only just managed to shove the burning mattress away as he staggered to his feet. He immediately fell to his knees, then a hulking shape materialized in the smoky gloom, hooked a big hand under Santoro's armpit, dragged him to his feet, and pulled him out of the cell into the hall. The sounds of gunfire were muted by partial deafness from the blast. Santoro struggled to make sense of what just happened. The roaches had exploded. Exploded.
How?
He stammered. Dylan pulled him roughly along the corridor. You want to talk or do you want to live? Those words seemed to reach past Santoro's pain and confusion and flip a switch, an old, disused switch. In the space of 3 yards, he went from a stumbling victim to a man running as if he owned the moment, as if he owned himself again. By the time they reached the stairs, Santoro was running faster than the big guard. They ran through smoke and shadows, more explosions rocked the prison, and the chatter of gunfire was continual, loud enough to drown out the screeching alarms. There was a security door to the stairs, and it stood open, blocked by a black duffel bag. Another guard was just inside the stairwell, but he lay in a broken sprawl, his head twisted too far around. Dylan snatched up the bag and kicked the door shut. He knelt fast, jerking down the bag's zipper, and began pulling items out and tossing them to Santoro. Kevlar body armor, limb pads, a ballistic helmet. And weapons, a 6-hour handgun and an M4 carbine. There was a 2-pocket shoulder pouch fat with loaded magazines for each. Santoro took a pistol and shoved it into his pocket along with extra magazines and accepted a rifle. He removed the magazine, checked that it was loaded, and slapped it back. The weapon felt as good as a lover in his hands. Dylan took a rifle as well, and looped a 2nd pouch over his broad shoulder. Here's the plan, he said tersely. This place is going to shit in a big way. Got maybe 600,000 to 800,000 crawlers in here, bugs and rats.
Rats?
They carry more C4.
Oh.
We're heading up to the roof, said Dylan. We got a couple of helos inbound, full of our guys. They're top private contractors, and they are being paid a shit ton of money to get you out. Big bonuses if you're unharmed. You're not worth a whole lot dead, so let's help them earn their cash, okay?
Dylan turned and ran along the corridor on the other side of the doorway. Santoro did not understand this and did not like it, but he was no fool. He ran to catch up. The corridor ended at another door, and the sounds of battle were so intense that they rattled the door in its frame. Dylan input a code and the door opened. They peered outside to see a tableau of pure carnage. The prison's guards were taking heavy fire from 4 combat helicopters. The 2 doing the most damage were a pair of lethal AH-1Z Vipers that hovered above the outer wall of the prison and rained down fire with 3-barreled M197 electric rotary cannons. The heavy caliber rounds punched through doors, windows, and body armor. The watchtowers were gone, blown to flaming debris by Hellfire missiles and Hydra 70 rockets. Massive chunks of the structure had been destroyed and pillars of smoke rose from the burning rubble. Until now, Santoro half believed that this was all some kind of deception, part of an elaborate and devious plan by Church to somehow win his trust and open him up. But now he understood that this was an actual rescue mission. It was Kuga, for real.
The Seven Kings had used his services a few times, but always at several removes. Kuga had a fetish for secrecy. Centauro had theories on who the legendary fixer was, but that's all they were. Why, though, would Kuga spend this much money and take these insane risks to free him? Dylan shoved him along the walkway.
Daydream later, he roared.
Prison guards were pouring fire at the invaders, but they were armed for a riot, not an invasion. Their body armor was designed to stop most conventional bullets, but offered no protection at all from armor-piercing rounds. Centauro saw the other two helicopters come sweeping around a burning tower. They were muscular Hueys with their side bay doors open. Rappelling lines tumbled out and mercenaries roped down, firing as they landed. Under cover fire from the helicopter chain guns, the soldiers ran across the shattered roof. But the battle had a third set of players. Two Apache attack helicopters were coming in hard and fast from the west. As Centauro watched, the lead bird fired a sidewinder that drilled a hole through the air and struck one of the Vipers. The explosion was massive, and as the fireball lit the night sky, the shockwave knocked the men, guards, and their attackers flat. The other helicopters rocked and tilted, spilling air, as the pilots fought for control. Centauro saw ropes dropping from one of the helicopters and black-clad figures slithering down, guns spitting fire.
"Who are they?"
cried Centauro. Dylan snarled, sounding scared.
"Fuck me, I think they're DMS."
Centauro, for all of his courage and strength, felt a shiver of icy fear stab him in the groin. He hissed and almost dodged back away from the door.
"They will slaughter your men," he warned. "They are devils."
"Leave it,"
yelled Dylan. Centauro ignored him and opened fire with his rifle. He hadn't fired a gun in years, but that did not matter. He was born to killing, and with every squeeze of the trigger, he became more fully alive. Men died, and in their deaths gifted him with new life. Centauro felt like a vampire feeding on the life force of these soldiers. He wanted to go down into the heat of this battle, to walk like a prince of death through the smoke and fire, reveling in red slaughter. DMS agents and prison guards, recognizing a new threat as their fellows died, turned to concentrate their return fire on him. But Centauro knew that he was blessed. He could feel the hand of the goddess on his shoulder, her words whispering into his ear.
"For me," she said. "Do this for me."
Tears ran from his eyes as he fired. Bullets struck the stone and the pipe rail and ricocheted into the fiery darkness, but none touched him. How could they? His faith had been restored, and with it the power he once owned. The goddess had not abandoned him. No, she was with him now, in this hour of death and liberation. And so he killed for her. He killed and killed and killed. And, as if recognizing that a master of death was among them, Dylan's own team redoubled their efforts and the prison became a true killing ground. Above them, Dylan's helicopters moved up and away from the prison to gain maneuvering room for combat. All of the gunships were firing now, filling the night sky with tracers and the hiss of rockets. The air seemed to explode around them. Shrapnel rained down on the prison, cutting down the guards and Dylan's own troops. One of the Hueys erupted into a massive fireball, and Dylan shoved Centauro back from the flaming debris. Centauro pulled free of him and ran to where one of Dylan's men was fumbling to fix a new rocket-propelled grenade into the launcher, having failed to hit anything on his first try. Centauro tore the weapon from the man with such force that the soldier fell and struck his head on the pipe rail. Centauro snapped the grenade into place, turned, steadied the stock against his shoulder, and fired. The grenade shot into the air, trailing a serpentine coil of dense gray smoke. The DMS pilot banked hard to try and avoid it, but he was a second too late, and Centauro's round slammed into the Hydra rocket pod. The massive explosion punched the helicopter sideways in the air. As its flaming mass fell, Centauro saw the faces of the crew catch fire. It struck the wall, 80 feet away. The second Apache fired and took a Viper in the tail rotor, spinning it into a death spiral that slammed onto the unforgiving desert floor. Six of Dylan's team, encouraged by what Santoro had done, fired RPGs at it, and the chopper pilot almost slipped them all. The last one hit just below the door, and the blast sent the pilot flying into the air. He fell in pieces, and his Apache landed on top of him.
"Go, go, go!"
yelled Dylan, as his remaining Huey dropped down so that its skids scraped along the wall. Santoro dropped the grenade launcher and ran. Hands reached out to pull him and Dylan inside. The Viper angled in nearby and fired all of its remaining missiles and rockets, and as the Huey rose, the entire prison seemed to be engulfed in flame. Even the stones seemed to burn. The hellish orange glow painted the landscape in fire. Then both helicopters were moving away, accelerating. Santoro clung to a restraining strap and leaned out to watch. Mr. Church would have people search through the ruins, sift through the ash to look for his body. How long would it take? As if in answer, there was another, much larger explosion than any that had come before. One massive corner of the prison seemed to break apart as a massive bloom of fire and heat expanded outward from its core. Walls and turrets disintegrated in a fireball of burning destruction. Shockwaves chased the chopper into the air, buffeting it, nearly pulling it down into the fiery hell. Alarms shrieked, and the rotors struggled for purchase in the sky. It was close, so close. But the helicopter rose above the burning fingers of death and moved away into the night. As the helicopter lifted away, Santoro saw something else that puzzled him. A small knot of armed men were clustered around a tall man who wore prison overalls identical to his own. The man looked very familiar, but Santoro could not place him. He turned toward Santoro and flashed a broad grin. Then his rescuers escorted him through rotor wash to a waiting helicopter. It lifted off, and a split second later two more helos came swooping in and fired missiles at the corner of the building where the other prisoner had been. They fired again and again, obliterating that part of the prison. Then they turned in midair and launched a new salvo at the area where Santoro had been held these last years. He stood there watching the building blow apart as if Satan himself had exhaled his fiery breath at it. Soon the prison was completely engulfed. The helicopter circled wide and began following the machine the first prisoner was on, flying in formation. However, when they were a few miles from the conflagration, the helo with the other prisoner peeled off and vanished into the night. Santoro turned once more to Dylan.
"Who is in that other helicopter? Who else did you help escape?"
The former guard just grinned.
"Here, have a beer."
He pressed a cold, sweating bottle into the former prisoner's hand and then clinked his own against it.
"Welcome back to the world. Things are going to get real fucking interesting."
Dylan threw back his head and laughed at his own cryptic joke. The choppers turned off their lights and flew like phantoms through the night.
Chapter 31. Goseong Dinosaur Museum, 618 Jaran Manro, Haemyeon, Goseong-gun, Gyeongsangnam-do, South Korea. Anil Tan was pretty sure someone was going to kill her. She stood in the empty main hall looking up at the fully articulated skeleton of an Allosaurus, all teeth and claws, an apex predator from the Jurassic period. 150 million years ago, this creature was the terror of any land it inhabited, fearing nothing. For Anil, there was nothing that could be a sharper contrast to who and what she was. 93 pounds, 5 feet tall, but only when wearing thick-soled sneakers, 22 years old, with no combat skills at all. She did not know a single martial arts move, had never fired or even picked up a gun, and could barely cut bread with a knife. All she had was her camera and her computer.
"Careful," said a voice behind her. "He looks hungry."
She screeched and jumped, then whirled as a man came up behind her. A chubby man in a uniform stood there looking aghast.
"Oh, hey, I'm sorry," the man said quickly.
It was Hyuk Cho, the night shift guard.
I was just playing. God, I didn't mean to scare you. Are you okay?
She wanted to punch him. She wanted to run. Instead, she forced a smile. Her heart was hammering, and it took real effort to take a full breath.
No, it's okay,
she lied.
You sure? You went white as a ghost?
Really, it's cool. I'm fine.
They spoke in Korean, which she could manage with a heavy accent. Cho was a local guy, lumpy and dull, but friendly enough, and he was often the only other person in the museum during these long nights. Normally, the quiet and privacy worked for Anil. Right now, she would have liked the place to be filled with 500 noisy kids and a bunch of parents or school teachers. Witnesses. Every one of who would have a cell phone camera, the modern safety net. The guard licked his lips.
Are you sure? It was stupid of me.
No, it's fine,
she said, touching his sleeve, then fished for a lie to make sense of her overreaction.
It's just this place gives me the creeps, all these monsters.
A slow, relieved smile found its way onto Cho's doughy face.
You're still new here. You get used to these cuties.
He nodded to the Allosaur.
And once the tourists are gone, this place can be pretty creepy.
Yes.
He cleared his throat.
So, you're okay?
I'm fine. And I'd better get back to work.
Anil gave Cho another weak smile and half a bow, then hurried toward the small office reserved for the IT people. She had to run a program on the demographics of the customers, enter all the email addresses from the sign-up sheets, and send them emails with dinosaur information and clickable links to membership and donation pages. She could feel the guard watching her.
He's not one of them,
she told herself.
He's too young.
In the reflection of the glass door to the computer room, she saw him standing there, still watching.
If he was one of them, I'd already be dead.
That was true enough. Once the museum closed, the rest of the staff got out of there pretty quickly and the doors were locked. She was lucky she'd gotten here on time. It was close. The man with the boat knew how to slip past all the spotter planes and watching eyes and had gotten her from North Korean waters to a secure section of coastline down here where her car was discreetly parked. She'd broken so many laws that she lost count, but her fear was not of the police or the border patrols for North or South Korea. It was them. They would want her stopped. They would want her dead, not just silenced, but killed. She had no idea who, or when, or where, but someone would try. They would have to try. If she was in their place, she would too. Well, if she was a government flunky and sociopath. And now, there would be four sociopaths making calls to have her found and killed. As she locked herself into the computer room, Anil tried to tell herself that she didn't care, that she was too hard to find, too anonymous, too much of a nobody. After all, she worked in a dinosaur museum. Who would ever think to look for her here? When she peeked through the blinds, she saw the guard turn and walk slowly away, beginning his rounds.
Please, please, please,
she begged silently. It felt like a prayer, but to who? She had no faith, no religion. She removed her tablet and set it on the desk next to the museum's tabletop workstation. Then she took the thumb drive from a hidden compartment in her purse. It took every ounce of her courage to attach it to a small rerouter device and then plug it into the tablet via a short cable.
Please,
she said aloud, hearing that word stutter and falter. She took a ragged breath, nodded to herself, and then tapped the keys to upload the video file to an email. It took even more courage to hit send. Then she quickly disconnected everything and stashed the thumb drive and rerouter back into their compartments. It was done. There was nothing more she could do but wait and pray to an empty heaven that someone would listen. pray that the world wasn't about to end. Fearing, though, that despite everything she'd done and all the risks she had taken, that it was already too late. Chapter 32. Embassy of the United States, 188 Sejong Dairo, Sejongno, Jongnu-gu, Seoul, South Korea, 4 hours ago. Julian Paik had been the ambassador to South Korea for 16 months. He liked the job, not loved it, but he was getting there. Although he was very much an American, third generation from Georgetown, Paik loved his heritage. His family spoke Korean and English almost interchangeably at home and at holiday gatherings. Paik knew the history of Korea, going all the way back to Gojoseon, and as an undergrad considered pursuing a degree in Korean studies. The law called him with a clearer voice, though, and he went into immigration law and later international politics. He'd worked his way up through various offices over the years, aiming his career at a new target, the job he now had. He knew that his tenure would not outlast the current presidency, but it was a joy of a job, challenging in interesting ways, despite some frustrations related to the ongoing denuclearization talks. Paik did not personally believe that North Korea would ever stop their nuclear program, rather the reverse, and although that made him a bit nervous, it was unlikely the North Koreans would drop nukes on their own doorstep. He saw it as sword-rattling by a fragile regime that was only still in existence because China was propping them up. It was all a way of waging an economic war against America without anyone actually dying. That worked for Paik, because it meant that his job was never going to be boring. And once his term was over, he would be able to slide right into the private sector with a seven-figure salary at any of the corporations doing trade here in Asia. Life, as he saw it, was pretty damn good. He was drinking tea and listening to a recording of the Bucheon Philharmonic Orchestra's superb Mahler series when an email pinged. He frowned at it because of what was written in the subject bar. "Read this now. Crisis. All caps." Paik very nearly dismissed it as spam. Although the embassy's spam filters were excellent, some junk always managed to slip through. If he'd been even a little busier, he might have ignored it or put it in a folder for his assistant to read and vet. But something about it tickled at him in the wrong way. It gave him a flutter of unease, and so he clicked on it. A graphic popped up with a logo of a crazy-looking cartoon woman laughing maniacally as she leaned sideways around her laptop. The words "Punk Press" were written in dozens of languages inside little word balloons that rose from the computer and popped. Almost immediately a video began playing, and the first few seconds of it were overlaid by five short sentences. "This is not fake. This footage was taken this morning. This is real. We need you to do the right thing. You need to stop this from starting a war." But the email had been simultaneously sent to ambassadors in China and the United States and to the North Korean government. The video played out and Julian Paik sat there, stunned, horrified. At the end of the video was another message. "This is real. You can tell. You can check. We don't want to share this with the world because of what will happen. We sent this to you because you're a good man. You're always the one to try and calm things down, to keep the fools with missiles from pushing the buttons just to prove how tough they are. I hope you are the person people think you are. I hope you understand what this means. I hope you will figure some way of dealing with this. If not you, who?" There was more, but it was a set of instructions for where to post a reply. Julian Paik sat at his desk, feeling faint, feeling terrified. His hands were shaking when he reached for the phone.
Chapter 33 Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. I gave Rudy the full tour and then we settled down at a table in the staff lounge. We had an honest-to-God barista coffee roast master, or whatever it's called. His name is Mustafa and he is a sorcerer of the coffee bean. He is definitely going to be added to my will.
"Just brewed a fresh pot, Colonel," he said, beaming a great smile.
Mustafa is short, round, brown, and happy as hell all the time. He took my special cup from below the counter, rinsed it with very hot water, and filled it with steaming and aromatic heaven. The cup was a gift from Bunny. It had a picture of a World War II soldier holding a cup and grinning. The caption is, "How about I pour you a nice fresh cup of shut the fuck up?" I love that mug. It makes my coffee taste even better. He poured Rudy's from a separate pot, handed me a wire basket of fresh muffins, and gave me a small bag with some grain-free dog treats shaped like little coffee pots for Ghost. I told him that he was a very nice man. I followed Rudy to a small table by a window. Well, a fake window. It was actually a live feed projected onto a massive video screen framed like a window. It showed an eastern view of the island. Rudy remarked on it.
"This is smart," he said. "Not only are there four windows like this everywhere, but if my phone's compass app is correct, then they are positioned to show correctly oriented views. It makes being underground tolerable."
He touched his hand to the screen and smiled.
"The glass is warm, as if the sunlight up there is really light on window glass. Subtle and remarkable."
"Lean close and listen," I suggested. He did, and his eyes grew wide.
"I can hear the waves," he said, grinning like a happy child. "And seagulls."
I winked at him and fed one of the cookies to Ghost. He took it with great delicacy and settled down to eat it in tiny bites. He does that.
"So," said Rudy, settling back in his chair, "your Colonel Ledger now. Felicidades, mi coronel."
"Don't start. Seriously, I'm happy for you." "I'm not," I said. But Church insisted. He said something about colonels being more widely respected and that taking a new rank would allow me to function more efficiently with governments and groups we interact with, blah, blah, blah. His eyes twinkled with amusement.
"You disapprove?"
"Fuck, man, I was never entirely comfortable with being a captain. I was only a sergeant in the army, and that's the rank I earned."
"You don't feel deserving of a promotion? Even after all you've accomplished, all the good you've done?"
I snorted. "Dude, it's a fake rank. Rogue Team International is a made-up organization, so Church calling me a colonel is about as valid as calling me Grand Poobah. It's convenient and that's it." He brushed a speck of something from the sleeve of his suit coat.
"I am tempted to only call you Grand Poobah henceforth."
"I will hurt you very, very badly."
"Ah, threats of violence," mused Rudy. "The last resort of the macho male overcompensator."
"And bury your body where it will never be found," I added.
"I will block out some time later to be afraid."
He tore off a piece of a bran muffin, munched it for a moment. Then I saw him smile as he looked past me to where an overweight, somewhat threadbare old marmalade tabby cat lay in a patch of faux sunlight. Ghost went over and laid down next to the cat, and soon they were both asleep like spoons in a drawer. "Yeah," I said, "Cobbler's still hanging on."
"He's, what, 17 now?"
18, last week. Rudy nodded. He remembered Cobbler as a spry young cat a million years ago. My version of a therapy animal, I suppose. Ghost and Cobbler used to fight like, well, cats and dogs, but as Cobbler's gotten older, the big shepherd has shifted from aggressive to protective. Rudy leaned back in his chair and gazed deeply into his coffee cup.
I read the field report on the Jacobson matter and had a phone consult with the therapist assigned to Astrid.
Astrid's a tough young lady, I said. Rudy poured a yellow packet of raw sugar into his coffee, which is odd, because his drink of choice these days is a venti half whole milk, 1/4 1%, 1/4 non-fat, extra hot, split quad shots, 2 shots decaf, 2 shots regular, no foam latte with whip, 2 packets of Splenda, a touch of vanilla syrup, and 3 short sprinkles of cinnamon from Starbucks. The sad thing is the poor beleaguered baristas have to make that crap. Now he was pouring 1 packet of real sugar into a cup of black decaf coffee. He caught me watching, but made no comment. Rudy likes to mess with me sometimes, which I'm pretty sure is unethical, since he's my shrink.
Toughness, he said as he stirred, is both conditional and relative. Astrid needed to be tough while things were unfolding. That's a survival skill. However, now that she's been rescued, she's having a very hard time adjusting her worldview to fit what happened. Not only was she kidnapped and subjected to physical harm and the threat of sexual violence, but she was also a witness to extreme violence. She saw you kill people.
Very bad people, I said, pouring milk into my coffee. No sugar. I took an experimental sip. Nice.
It doesn't entirely matter that they were bad people, cowboy, he said, using my old boyhood nickname. Astrid was there when extreme violence occurred. Exposure to that leaves a mark on every person.
Violence always leaves a mark, I said, quoting his favorite maxim. It made Junie's words echo in my head, and I avoided Rudy's eyes.
It does, Rudy replied. And for each person, the severity of that mark is different. For some, it's a badge of honor. For others, it is a crippling injury. And there are countless variations in between. You have been marked, said Rudy, as have I. We are friends and have many shared experiences. But those things we each experienced are unique to us as individuals. You carry your scars differently than I ever could.
I'm a soldier and you're not. He smiled.
I did not say you carried them better, Joe. I said differently.
Ah, I said. Right, sorry. Okay, that's a point for Junie, I thought.
Astrid is a teenager, he said. Her challenge at processing what she experienced is complex.
He drank some coffee, winced at the taste, and added a second packet of sweetener.
She was taken to be used as a tool against her father. If her father turned over all his files to save her, then she thinks she would be partly at fault for any deaths resulting from the release of the mycotoxin. She knows her father was willing to sacrifice himself to save her, but at the same time she now knows that her father broke the rules set by her kidnappers by having a rescue mission attempted. There are a lot of subtleties in there that a fragile mind can use to construct more guilt and also resentment toward her father. And she knows that people were killed by her rescuers. To a person as empathic and sensitive as Astrid, she holds herself responsible for their deaths.
They were scumbags who would have raped and killed her.
How does that matter? Asked Rudy. To her, I mean. They were people. She sees them in a broader framework than you do. She sees their lives, their families, parents, spouses, children. She wonders whether they were truly corrupt or just following orders because there would be consequences for not doing so, and on...
I sat back and stared at the air over his head. Ghost got up, came over, and laid his head on my thigh, and I scratched his thick white fur.
Jesus Christ, I said.
When a team like yours rescues someone, Rudy said gently, they are rescuing a victim of trauma. The person you bring out is not, and cannot possibly be, the person who was taken, and definitely not the person they were in the moments before they were aware they were about to be abducted. Each step of that process inflicts a wound, and the effect is cumulative.
I looked away. He was too compassionate to add something as trite as you well know. Of course I knew. And like Astrid, I could look back to see the person I was before an act of terrible violence changed the trajectory of my life. When I was 14, my girlfriend Helen and I were walking in a park on a lovely spring afternoon, busy with falling in love for the first time, filled with all the excitement and optimism that comes with that bit of magic. Then we were attacked by four older teens. They were bigger and stronger, and their minds were furnaces of hatred and awful need. They beat me to a pulp, and while I lay there broken and bleeding, I got to see the process of Helen being destroyed. Unlike Astrid, no one came to rescue Helen. We both survived the day, kind of. We were broken, and none of the king's horses and none of the king's men could piece us together again. Helen withdrew into herself and, years later, opted out of the whole horror show. I found what was left of her. Cooling, rancid meat that was proof to me that the world could be a dark, ugly, and evil place. She died. And I lived. I was not whole, though. The initial attack and her suicide splintered me. It was Rudy, then a young resident, who helped me put some of the pieces together, discarding fragments of my personality that no longer fit and teaching me to make peace with what was left. I had three different aspects to my personality that were so distinct that they had their own names. The modern man, the version of me who might have lived a normal life if Helen and I hadn't been attacked. My default personality was the cop, analytical, introspective, observant, and dedicated to the procedural cause and effect. And then there was the killer. He was a savage, primal and uncompromising, deeply protective of what he perceives as the vulnerable members of his tribe, and absolutely merciless when he goes hunting for the bad guys. They all warred for control, and Rudy helped me negotiate the terms of our ongoing truce. I looked back and remembered the day I left the hospital a few weeks after the attack. I went to the closest dojo and signed up. The cop part of me became obsessed with learning to be strong because I knew full well the cost of being weak. I became strong, too. I became a monster who fed on other monsters. The killer emerged through that process. Most of the time I was a creature of peace who loved a nicely grilled steak on Super Bowl Sunday, icy glasses of craft beer, summer days on a sunny beach, and good old-fashioned rock and roll. Until I wasn't. When I rolled into a fight, the cop tried to keep things copacetic, but when things got freaky, he unchained the killer and let him run wild. And it was that monster who'd rescued Astrid, and it was that monster who helped mark her young soul. Not meaning to, but doing it all the same. Junie knew all of this, too. And I think I was probably angry with her because her comments made me feel like she'd forgotten or ignored all that. Now I was seeing it differently. Rudy reached out and laid his hand on my forearm, giving it a gentle and reassuring squeeze. I was in my own head, but he knew the twisted paths my thoughts would take. He let me know that I was never alone. I opened my mouth to tell him about the conversation with Junie and to ask his opinion about why my recent gunfights don't seem to have affected me, but I never got the chance. The lounge door opened and the duty officer came hurrying into the room.
"Colonel Ledger," she said breathlessly, "the big man wants you in the talk right away. Something's come up."
Chapter 34 The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. The TOC is the Tactical Operations Center, and it's where all field ops are overseen. It's a big room with a massive bank of high-def computer screens filling one wall and a big half-circle of computer workstations facing it on a series of tiers. Looks a bit like Mission Control for the NASA launches, but maybe we're more high-tech. Mr. Church stood on the top step beside a shorter, very thin man who had stick-like legs and a weirdly long neck and looked like a wading bird. Maybe an egret, but with sandy hair and steel-rimmed glasses. Scott Wilson was the chief of operations, and he was the poor, unfortunate bastard who had to try and fill the shoes of Aunt Sally. No one could ever do that, of course, and everyone knew it. Wilson knew it, too. Auntie had been with Church for decades and was retired now, working her way through a very slow recovery from a very bad stroke. Wilson, though a former SAS shooter and a bit of a badass in his own right, had no chance with people who'd worked with Auntie. It was like hiring a really tough pit bull to replace a Tyrannosaurus Rex. The sense of proportion was all wrong. That said, Wilson was sharp as hell when it came to mission strategy, especially in the implementation of the latest generation of high-tech combat aids. That included everything from sophisticated computer-enhanced body armor to a slew of specialty tactical drones. And maybe drones were a particular favorite of his, because since signing on, he'd encouraged Doc Holliday to acquire as many different kinds of drones as she could, from high-flying new-generation predators to swarms of micro-drones the size of houseflies. It was his wish one day to send fewer human assets and more robots into battle. I can see his point and can certainly admire his goal of preserving human life, but I've dealt with combat drones, and it didn't leave me with the warm fuzzies. After all, a good third of that stuff was scary shit we'd taken away from the bad guys in the old DMS days. Wilson was also much more of a diplomat than Auntie, who was cranky to an Olympic level. Wilson often coordinated inter-jurisdictional field ops involving 30 different countries and some of America's more covert teams, like Chess Team, Sigma Force, and MHI. Before coming to RTI, he'd been the chief operations officer for Barrier, which was the British group within MI6 that was Church's model for the Department of Military Sciences. So, yeah, he had all the street cred he needed, but even so, Auntie, you know? One of a kind. Church turned as I approached. "Did Bug get anything on that Emir Zelioglu joker?" I asked. "Do we know who he is yet? Because I'd love to put that son of a bitch in the morgue." "That bit of mayhem will have to wait, Colonel," said Church. "Something else has come up." "Shit," I said. "What's on fire now?"
"Currently," said Wilson, "a little nothing of an island off the coast of North Korea."
"Literally on fire?"
"No," said Church, "though that might be better than what we are facing."
"I hate it when you say shit like that," I muttered.
"I hate it when I have to, Colonel." Church gestured to the screen. "This is Gegouli Siom." I worked out the translation. "Island of Frogs, never heard of it."
"No reason you should have done," said Wilson in his crisp Eton accent. "It has a small fishing village with a population of 186. Or at least it did so, until last night. There was a satellite flyover using thermal scans, and it's currently estimated that the population is zero. That includes, by the by, a platoon of North Korean regulars who were sent in to investigate, and the two-man staff of a small sonar station. The station was established apparently to watch for an American submarine invasion of the North Korean mainland."
"Which is never going to happen," I suggested.
"God forbid," snorted Wilson.
"To invade North Korea would be to declare war on China. But the propagandists need to engender fear in order to control the population, hence the sonar station."
I studied the thermal overlay on the image and saw that a few heat signatures were there, but but they were cooling to the point where they'd vanish from the scan. "Everyone's dead?" I asked. "How?" "I didn't hear about earthquakes or a tsunami, so what happened? They have a nuclear plant there that melted down?"
"No," said Wilson. "Apart from the sonar station, there is no industry or military presence at all on the island. They don't even have electricity, apart from a few shared diesel generators."
"Then why is everyone dead?"
"We don't know," said Church. "And neither, apparently, do the North Koreans. One of the members of the sonar team attempted to send a distress call, but it was cut off. They sent in a small platoon via boat to investigate, and they failed to report. A second team was sent, this time by helicopter, and shortly after arrival, they stopped broadcasting."
I looked at the image and saw that the digital clock was feeding real-time data. Why am I not seeing the entire North Korean Navy converging on the site?
"'Cause the upper echelon of that government doesn't yet know about this," said Wilson.
I glanced at him. "You lost me. How do we know and they don't?"
"It's complicated. Uncomplicated for me."
Wilson turned to Church and raised his eyebrows. "Colonel," began Church,
"you are aware that I have a number of associates positioned in key places throughout the world, business, various governments, and so on.
You're friends in the industry."
He measured out a microscopic slice of a smile. "Yes. Over the last few years, as the governments of key nations have become increasingly unstable due to election tampering, I've cultivated a new set of friends. Diplomats in crucial positions, as well as some members of the military of various nations."
"Should I even ask how you manage that?" I asked.
He usually ignores questions like that, but this time he surprised me. "You may be encouraged to know that, despite the bluster of a growing number of unstable world leaders, there are a fair number of much cooler heads within those governments. People who have chosen to either remain in place during regime changes, or who have entered into service with a new administration because they believe in the concept of checks and balances. It is no exaggeration at all to say that wars have been prevented by quiet phone calls or coded emails. The global stock market has been propped up at times by a word here or a warning there. Understand, this is not a network built on party politics, anyone's party, or personal gain. These people believe that there needs to be, as you often say, an adult in the room. Or as Brick likes to say, a designated driver."
"Wow," I said.
"You have no idea," breathed Wilson. "These people," continued Church, "are aware of the existence of Rogue Team International. They understand that our agenda is to exert agency over global threats that would otherwise be dangerous for any one government to handle. This case may be exactly the sort of thing we formed RTI to address."
"Okay, that's pretty badass," I said. "So, who called, and what happened on the island?"
"Second question first," said Wilson. He bent over and used the trackpad on a laptop to change from a satellite view to the feed from a drone that was closer to the ground.
The drone flew slowly over a small village that was little more than a cluster of shacks and huts around a central town square. I watched with a sinking stomach as what at first appeared to be irregularities in the landscape resolved into bodies. Many, many bodies. In a sick and hollow voice, Wilson said,
"As far as we can tell, Colonel, everyone on Gaigulisom is dead."
I walked down the steps to stand closer to the screen. It was so densely pixelated that you could actually get within inches and examine minute details. I've been on site for a lot of slaughters in my time, and I used to be a cop. In essence, what I saw was one big crime scene. Bodies everywhere, and even a blind man could see that this had been a mutual slaughter. I walked along the massive screen, letting it tell me a story, and the tale it told was a horror story.
"Jesus Christ," I said. They all killed each other.
Interlude 6. In flight, 30 miles from the California border, 15 months ago. Rafael Santoro tried talking to the crew aboard the Huey, but apart from simple politeness, no one would engage him in any meaningful conversation. Not even Dylan, who sat in the corner drinking beer after beer. They would not tell him where they were going, who they were going to see, or why they had broken him out of the prison. No one would explain anything about the exploding roaches or rats, and now that he was away from the prison, he took the opportunity to consider what they must have been. Prior to his incarceration, he'd read about advances in robotics. It was not something of direct interest to the Seven Kings, and his interest lasted about as long as it took to read a magazine article. Now bits of it came back. He closed his eyes and let information float to the top of the troubled soup of his thoughts. There was a word, an acronym. CRAM? Yes, that was it. Remembering the full name took a few moments, but it came. Compression-resistant articulated mechanism. A radical new kind of designer robot, very small and designed to imitate the qualities of actual roaches. Those insects, ancient and beautiful, were designed to survive virtually anything. They can withstand nearly 1,000 times their own body weight without injury, and compress their bodies to fit through a quarter-inch gap. The roaches in the article, though, were very clearly artificial, structures of wire and cardboard. The ones in his cell had looked exactly like real roaches. That had fooled him, and Santoro disliked being fooled. They'd also spoken to him. The voice was soft, soothing, personal, and it had shared so many secrets with him, quoting scriptures from the writings of the goddess, telling Santoro things about the Seven Kings that no one knew, not even church. Over a period of many weeks, the roaches had come to him as messengers of a higher power. Now, he knew that to be a lie. The roaches had been robots, and clearly each carrying a small amount of explosives so that when clustered, there was enough destructive force to blow open his cell. He assumed the rats were of a similar nature. Smart. Very practical, which is something Santoro always appreciated. And yet the vermin were a lie. Everything the roaches told him was a lie. The truth may have actually set him free, but there was an insult buried within it. He wrestled with that. On one hand, it snapped him out of the religious torpor into which he'd lapsed. On the other, whoever sent them, his mysterious benefactor, had lied to him, using Santoro's faith as a tool of manipulation. That was very nearly unforgivable. He sipped his beer and stared out at the darkened landscape. He was free now, and he would die before letting anyone put him back in a cage. That included being trapped in a cage of his own beliefs. The miles blurred into the blackness of the empty land below. Chapter 35. The Talk, Phoenix House, Amphorae Island, Greece. Church and Wilson came down to stand with me. My own words seemed to hang in the air. They all killed each other.
So it would appear, said Church softly.
But how?
Why? I demanded. A plague of murder?
Shit, is this more of the God Machine?
We don't know, said Wilson.
The God Machine was a device created using a dangerous and radical kind of science. One of the effects of it was that it could drive a percentage of the people exposed to it to commit murder or suicide. In our last DMS case, Washington, D.C. was hit with a brutal wave of the God Machine effect. Since then, though, we had gone to great lengths, very, very great lengths, to make sure that all traces and examples of the God Machine were eradicated.
We weren't nice about it either. We broke laws and cut throats and did a lot of damage, because that technology was one of the most dangerous we'd ever encountered, and that is saying a whole damn lot.
We don't know? I echoed.
Well, fuck, man, what do we know?
The screen was so shockingly clear that it was like standing right there among all the death. Scores of bodies, from the very old to the newly born. None of them were whole. They were torn apart by knives and jagged pieces of pottery, stabbed with farm tools and broken tree branches, beaten with fists and smashed by any blunt object that was apparently close at hand, and many of them, far too many, had been savaged by teeth. The bite marks were there to be read, as were the red smears on dead mouths.
We don't know anything for sure, said Church.
At first, said Wilson quietly, we thought it was more of the rabies.
A little over a year ago, I helped break a case involving a global distribution of a weaponized strain of rabies that used pertussis as a delivery system. Groups like FreeTech, the World Health Organization, and others, backed by financial and logistic aid from the United Nations, had virtually eradicated it, but there was always a danger of outbreaks in isolated areas.
It's not that, I said, because it affected the soldiers. Any armed platoon would have been inoculated, and they wouldn't be overwhelmed by unarmed civilians.
That was the conclusion we reached as well.
Wilson shifted the picture to other places on the island. I saw families locked in the stillness of a terminal death struggle, children biting the parents who strangled them, infants ripped to pieces, young couples locked in sexual embraces while clutching the knives they'd used to murder each other.
Then this is what, some kind of new bioweapon? I asked. If so, what? Who used it and to what end? This island looks like it's on the ass end of nowhere. Why do this?
Wilson said,
we don't have enough intel to make any good guesses, Colonel. All we know is that it appears to have affected, or perhaps infected, everyone on the island. We know that it has a rate of onset that is both alarming and unnatural. No pathogen in nature could cause such radical and specific behavioral changes as quickly as what appears to have happened here. For a platoon of soldiers to have been affected so fast, they could not radio in a report. You'd need a pathogen that hits at the speed of a neurotoxin.
Show me the soldiers, I said, and Wilson shifted the image again. There, corpses sprawled in silent ugliness along a jungle footpath. It looked like a few had beaten each other to death with their weapons, while others clearly stood a few feet apart and emptied their magazines at one another.
It's not Saif al-Din, either, I said, referring to another and far more dangerous engineered pathogen.
Fear of that weapon is what led to Church hiring me into the old Department of Military Sciences. It stood as our worst case scenario since then, and none of us were anxious to find out about something bigger and badder. If it had been Saif al-Din, the dead people would still be walking around and they wouldn't have been able to use weapons.
Jesus Christ, what is this?
It was rhetorical by now.
Church said, I've taken the liberty of alerting Havoc Team. They are loading a helo with weapons, electronics, and hazmat gear. A jet will be smoking on the tarmac in Athens by the time you get there. Bug is smoothing the clearances.
We're going to the island?
Yes, said Wilson. Your cover is that of a specialized hot zone field team freelancing with the World Health Organization. You are a South African private contractor. Each of your team will have similar credentials, completely unbreakable.
Okay.
You'll fly to Osan Air Base in Pyeongtaek and meet with Colonel Epps, commander of the 51st Fighter Wing.
He's a friend, said Church quietly. At Osan, you'll be introduced to Lieutenant Colonel Ho Yongju, said Wilson. He is a doctor attached to the People's Army Special Operation Force.
I grunted. were working with the sanction of the North Korean government?
Ho is a friend of a friend,
said Church. How far can I trust him?
As far as your own judgment,
said Church.
However, Ho is not a hawk. He has been at his current rank for some time now, getting only lateral promotions, because he tends to err on the side of humanism rather than being overtly political. He's never come out and spoken against his government, but it's clear the party leaders don't consider him one of their creatures. He's very good at his job, however, and has taken point on some crucial disease outbreak responses. At a distance, he appears to be a moral person trying to do his best in a difficult and restrictive political circumstance.
Understood, I said.
Colonel Epps will provide transport to the coast, said Wilson, where you'll take a non-military RHIB belonging to the WHO.
What is the actual mission? I asked.
Assessment. Gather intel, gather samples, and get out, said Wilson. Take no undue risks.
Church said, your comms will be a team channel at all times, unless you actively switch to a private channel. It is likely that access to the team channel will be shared with select persons in the governments of North and South Korea, China, and the U.S.
Well, fuck.
This situation is fragile, Church said, and transparency might help us keep fingers off of the wrong buttons.
But hey, no pressure, right?
Church measured out a small smile. You could have chosen a less stressful profession. Lion tamer, bomb disposal, yeah.
We stood looking at the pain and horror and death on the Island of Frogs.
Church reached out and touched the screen, resting his finger on the image of a Korean soldier who lay next to a comrade he had beaten to death. The beaten soldier's face was literally battered to an inhuman pulp, and the attacker's hands were mangled bits of raw gristle, with pieces of his own bones sticking out through torn flesh. The soldier had a bayonet in his stomach, but it hadn't killed him before he'd done all of that awful damage.
Before you go, Colonel, he said quietly, tell me something. If you had to put a word to all of this, the emotion of it, what would you call it? Give it a name.
I didn't have to think very hard because one word was painted there on every inch of torn skin and broken lives. It was ground into the bloody dirt and burned into the day.
Rage, I said.
Church said,
yes.
I turned to him. There's another shoe to drop, isn't there? We don't get called in because of shit like this. What's the rest?
Church gave me a small nod of approval. Wilson used the remote to open a new window on the screen, and immediately a video began playing. I stood there and watched in shock and horror as something unfolded that made no sense, but was as real as all the other horrors I'd so far seen.
Oh my God, I breathed. The ambassador of South Korea contacted me because he'd received that video, said Church very quietly. He knew that I have contacts inside North Korea, and together we came up with a plan that might keep this from starting a war. I need you on the ground, on Frog Island. I need you to get ahead of this thing.
I didn't answer. No need. I was already running for the door.
Interlude 7. Wildlife Road above the Point Doom Bluffs, Malibu, California, 15 months ago. The helicopter did not take Santoro to meet his rescuer. The plan was a great deal more complicated than that. The choppers landed in the parking lot of a large and remote industrial complex in the Mojave Desert in California. There, Santoro and six other people, four men and two women, were ushered inside. There was a surprisingly well-appointed series of room suites where they were each allowed to shower, eat, and dress. He stood naked in the shower for long minutes, hands braced on the tiles, head bowed, letting the hot water boil away the memories of prison showers. Dirt, brick dust, gunpowder residue sluiced down his limbs, carrying with them flecks of memories of all the indignities imposed upon him.
They swirled around the drain and washed away. After many minutes, he turned off the spray, dried himself slowly and carefully on a towel that was so soft it made him want to cry. He found combs, brushes, toothbrush and paste, deodorant and expensive colognes in a basket on the sink. There was also a voice-activated music system accompanied by a small handwritten note with instructions. Santoro tried it and was delighted with the device. He cleared his throat and leaned toward a small, wall-mounted microphone.
"Please play Domenico Scarlatti."
"Which piece by Giuseppe Domenico Scarlatti would you like to hear?" asked a pleasant female voice.
"Stabat Mater?"
he said, posing it as a question.
"Playing Stabat Mater by Scarlatti, performed by Stefano Lentini, featuring Sandra Pastrana and the City of Rome Contemporary Music Ensemble."
And immediately, the music began to play. Santoro stood there smiling, dazzled, and for a moment he was a teenager again, standing outside of a music hall, listening to a small college orchestra work their way through the piece. It was a heartbreaking work, exploring the Virgin Mary's suffering at the crucifixion of her son.
"Thank you,"
he said softly, not to Mary or even to Dylan's team. He thanked the goddess for grinding the gears of the universe to make this happen. Then he dressed in the chiton tonal plaid two-piece suit and hand-sewn Italian shoes. He put on the new Cartier Santos watch and matched the time to the wall clock. It matched to the second, a detail Santoro appreciated. He finished dressing and came out of the bedroom just as there was a subtle knock on the door. He opened for a man dressed in nondescript white hotel clothes who pushed in a wheeled cart on which was a lovely breakfast. Huevos a la flamenca, with tomato, peas, bell pepper, potatoes, chorizo, ham, and onion, topped with eggs and baked so that the egg whites were cooked but the yolk was runny. Perfect. There was toast and jam and a pot of tea. The waiter bowed and left. He sat down to eat, washing it down with three cups of tea, listening to the laments of Mary. An hour later, a guard came for him and very politely asked him to accompany him outside. There he found a sleek Saab 340 turboprop plane waiting. He was the sole passenger.
"What about the other prisoners?" he asked the pilot once he was aboard. The pilot merely smiled and did not answer.
The plane took off and flew all the way to a private airport near Malibu. A brand new Escalade was waiting, and the driver was as silent and mysterious as the pilot had been. And once Santoro was comfortable, a smoked glass window rose up to isolate him in the back. He could see the outline of the driver speaking on a cell phone, but could hear nothing. The whole process was, he decided, intended to impress. The silence of the staff was to demonstrate a level of loyalty and professionalism. The attack on the prison showed an investment of money and a high degree of professionalism, as well as meticulous timing. The luxury of the hotel suites inside a nondescript building, the clothes, the plane, and this car spoke to an appreciation of elegance, but not an absurd dedication to ostentation. That had been one of Hugo Vox's faults. He always liked to be seen to spend more than anyone else. Everything here was of quality, and that seemed to be the point. As for the breakfast, that was Santoro's favorite. It meant that someone in this organization had insight into him. He was impressed, but also unsettled. Very few people knew that much about him.
"Who are you?"
he mused.
"Do I know you? Did you know the goddess?"
The car took him to a beautiful property on Wildlife Road in Malibu, and this did edge toward ostentation. The place had to have a price tag north of $60 million. They passed through a gated drive and rolled under a lush canopy of trees. The short walk from the car to the house gave him glimpses of the ocean,
But once he was ushered into the living room, the glimpse turned into a breathtaking view of the vast blue Pacific. After being in solitary confinement for so long, the vista was the most beautiful thing he'd ever seen, which he knew was again part of the plan. Manipulation as well as a statement.
"It's lovely, isn't it?"
asked a voice, and Santoro turned to see a tall, handsome, older, middle-aged white man standing a dozen paces behind him. The man wore trousers that were a subtle eggshell shade, a pastel blue shirt, untucked, and no shoes. He looked like a movie star, the kind of actor who would play a president. He walked across the room with the kind of nonchalance that came from confidence. This was his place, and his sense of ownership seemed to extend out through the windows, past the sculptured gardens, and across the limitless waters. The man did not yet offer his hand. Instead, he came and stood next to Santoro, looking out at the water. They stood like that for several seconds, watching a group of parasailers fly like prehistoric birds above the waves. Santoro waited out the silence.
"Do you know who I am?" asked the tall man.
"You're the one they call Kuga,"
said Santoro. Chapter 36. Over Turkish Airspace. It was 5,300 miles from the airfield in Athens to our destination in Seoul. Havoc Team was burning along in a heavily modified Cessna Citation X, kitted out with extended-range fuel tanks that bumped its normal range of 3,460 miles to somewhere just under 5,000. We still had to make a refueling stop, but by then we'd be in China. When Wilson said that the clearances would be taken care of, he hadn't been joking. No one stopped us, and at the refuel stop we weren't even asked for papers or told to submit to inspection. Felt good, but also weird. And the urgency of it tended to ramp up the speed with which my gut was clenching into a tight, cold ball of dread. The bird had an 8-passenger capacity, but there were just the 5 of us. Like all RTI craft, the cabin was totally soundproofed and rigged with every kind of electronic doodad our science teams could manage. All of it was run by Calpurnia, our AI system. The team were in comfortable, butter-soft leather chairs with fold-up desks, complete with laptops. All mission briefing intel would later be transferred to smaller, flexible computers strapped to our forearms. Everyone was seated, and they all looked at me like the world's most dangerous group of school kids. Top Sims is 6 feet tall and as solid as a block of granite. He wore loose black pants, a gray t-shirt without logo or graphic, and had military athletic shoes that looked like sneakers but had metal alloy reinforcing toe caps and ribs. Nothing to indicate rank anywhere on his clothes. He had dark skin, salt and pepper hair cut very short, and a precisely trimmed goatee that he'd recently grown. It gave him a somewhat sinister look, which may have been his point. He nodded to me.
"What's the op?" he asked.
"Yeah," said Bunny. "We loaded enough gear to start World War III.
"Trying to do exactly the opposite," I said.
"Crap," he said. "I hate it when you say stuff like that."
Bunny was 6.5 feet of Orange County white boy with more muscles than anyone could reasonably use. Someone once remarked that he looked like he could bench press a school bus while getting a blowjob. Why a blowjob and not, say, a handjob is one of those things that only ever seems to make sense to cops and soldiers. Bunny was blonde, blue-eyed, easygoing, and good-natured everywhere, except in a fight. He and Top joined the old DMS when I did, and we've walked through the Valley of the Shadow more times than I can count. Bunny was drinking a Coke Slurpee and gestured with the cup.
"Bringing lots of guns to a peace conference? That's new for us."
"It's complicated," I said.
"Ain't it always complicated?"
"Welcome to the world of grown-ups, farm boy," said Top.
"Bite me, old man."
Seated across from them was Bell.
At a distance, you wouldn't think she was the deadly fighter we all knew her to be. She was a short, very slim woman whose body vanished in baggy clothes, but she was all hard muscle and wiry strength. She did not smile or join in the banter and rarely spoke at all. Never did. Always makes me wonder what her interior life is like. When you've been that seriously damaged in body and mind, the landscape of your soul can be a pretty damn bleak place. It could well be that every time Belle pulled a trigger on a bad guy, she was punching a hole in the dense cloud cover that darkened her life. I felt a strong kinship to her and deeply admired her courage and integrity. And it made me wonder what Junie would make of her. Andrea was sprawled across two seats with a leg hooked over an armrest, his foot swinging, and was squeezing a red hand conditioning ball.
So, Andrea said brightly, c'è il loro scroto blocciato in uno strizzatore ora.
Speak English, groused Bunny. He asked who has his nutsack in a ringer, I said, and it's a fair question.
All I can say in Italian is give me more pizza,
Bunny complained.
Questo purchase un babaro,
said Andrea as he tossed his ball in the air and caught it with his other hand.
I'm not a barbarian, stronzo.
Andrea gave him a wide grin that showed lots of very white teeth.
And you said you didn't speak Italian?
Top snorted.
Farm boy here only knows the insults, 'cause that's most what people say to him.
Hey, said Bunny. Top caught my eye, then gave everyone a glare.
Okay, now all y'all shut the fuck up and let the colonel talk.
I hit a key on my laptop and the aerial view of the island popped onto all of their laptop screens. This is Gaiguli Siom, I said, and explained where it was and what little we knew. I played the videos I'd seen and watched the humor evaporate from their faces. Belle sat up straight and then leaned forward, touching the screen much as Church had.
Ya Allah, Allah yarhamum.
She murmured. God save their souls.
Boss, said Bunny, am I seeing this wrong or did they all kill each other?
You ain't seeing it wrong, farm boy,
said Top. He gave me a hard look.
We talking super rabies here or God machine or...
I asked those same questions and I'll give you the same answers I got. We don't know, I told them. The brains at the talk tell me that there is a low probability this is anything we've seen before. There are similarities, but also notable differences. Onset rates, for example, and notable variations in the way in which violence was expressed. Self-harm as well as outward aggression. Right now we have zero reliable intel about the nature of the threat beyond what's on the video. Whatever it is, there appears to be a 100% infection rate and a 100% mortality rate. That is deeply frightening. Andrea held up his hand like a kid in school.
Perdonami, Colonello, but why are we even having a mission briefing on this? This island is in North Korea, yes?
Yes, I said, but there are complications.
Told you,
said Bunny. Top ignored him. I explained the situation with Mr. Church's friends, one of who was usefully placed in the emergency response chain of command in North Korea. The North Korean guy is the one who calls the shots on anything related to disease and outbreaks. That means his unofficial job is to prevent North Korea from looking weak and therefore bad in the eyes of the world. So, he is the man who keeps things on the DL.
Even to the point of not passing this up the party line?
Asked Top. He's stretching that a bit, taking some risks, I said, which means we have a window of a few hours once we're on the island. If this outbreak happened on the mainland, or anywhere near a military base, a government hub, or where tourists are likely to be, then he wouldn't be able to contain it at all. So this is an actual break. Andrea raised his hand.
Teacher, a question? Am I being paranoid for thinking that this outbreak is a bit too conveniently located? A nothing island in the middle of a nowhere part of the ocean with no one to give much of a muffled fart about what happens there? No cameras, no telephones, no Wi-Fi?
You are right to be paranoid,
I said. It stinks to high heaven, which brings me to the next part. And this is where it gets even more complicated.
Like I said, muttered Bunny.
I tapped a key to send them all the Punk Press homepage and froze the picture there for a moment. Punk Press is a WikiLeaks wannabe, I explained, with footprints all through Asia. No one knows who runs it because the feeds get bounced around through a sophisticated network of redirects. All we know is that it's most likely run out of somewhere in South Korea. The uploads are usually done via internet cafes, which means we can't pinpoint their physical location beyond where any given post was made. Watch the video, and then we'll talk. The Punk Press video began with a Google Maps satellite image of the Island of Frogs. A voiceover spoke in English, with translation crawls in Korean, Mandarin, Japanese, French, and Russian. The voice had been filtered through one of those apps that made it sound like a robot.
The following footage, said the voice, was taken last night on Gagaliseum, 18 nautical miles west of North Korea, in the sovereign waters of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. This video contains scenes with violent and graphic imagery that can be shocking or disturbing to some viewers.
There was a pause as the video shifted from the satellite image to what was clearly recorded with a GoPro camera with a night vision filter mounted on a small commercial drone. It was all in shades of bright green, black, and white. The lack of realistic colors did nothing to lessen the impact of what was being shown, though, and the warning wasn't really enough. I mean, how could it be? The footage showed villagers attacking one another. It was an angle on the village square that we'd already seen the aftermath of.
This was taken with surveillance cameras, said the narrator. It shows the people of Gagaliseum attacking each other as the result of exposure to an advanced bioweapon. As you can see, the designer pathogen creates an extreme state of violent madness.
On the screen there were true horrors. I watched my people as they watched it play out. Bell's eyes were glassy and filled with pain. Andrea tried for a poker face, but he was turning first pale and then green. Bunny sat with his fists balled and a snarl turning his young face ugly. As for Top, he was stone-faced, showing nothing, which meant that he was on one of those deep levels of anger that would need to have an outlet. I could relate.